Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. This is NPR News. I'm Chris Farrell, in today for Carrie Miller. One of the more intriguing public policy proposals getting increased attention these days is universal basic income. Now, the idea behind universal basic income is that everyone gets periodic income payments with no conditions attached to the money. The concept has conservative and liberal supporters, Silicon Valley billionaires like Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook and Elon Musk of Tesla. They're big fans. There are many experiments going on with variations of the idea around the world, including here in the U.S. So we're joined on the phone by Yomeya Puar. He's an alderman in Chicago, which is a city council person here. And he is advocating for a pilot universal basic income program in Chicago. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Also on the phone is Michael Howard, professor of philosophy at the University of Maine in Bangor. He is also coordinator of the U.S. Basic Income Guarantee Network. Thanks for joining us, Michael.
Glad to be here.
So, and we want to hear from you. I mean, what do you think of the idea of universal basic income? What would you like to understand better about this controversial idea? Call us at 651-227-6000, toll-free 800-242-2828. Online, talk at nprnews.org. Now, to start off, I'm going to ask both of you the exact same question, just so we're all on the same page. And I'll start out with you, Yomeya. What does universal basic income mean to you?
Well, I think in the traditional sense, it means that there's no strings attached and it's across the spectrum. There's no means test. What we're advocating for in Chicago as a pilot to get the conversation moving is that we develop a cohort of the most vulnerable populations in Chicago. I'm not set on any one definition in Chicago, but I want to get the conversation moving.
Okay. Michael?
Yeah, the most standard definition of a universal basic income is an income that goes to everybody. It is not means tested, so rich as well as poor receive it, and there are no behavioral conditions like work requirements or other conditions.
So, Michael, why is there so much interest in this idea now? I mean, you can't go to the New Yorker recently had an article, The Atlantic. My producers got together a booklet of information on this, and there are books that are being published, there are articles, there's these experiments going on in the world. Why now?
Yeah, I think there's been a longstanding interest that has to do with the persistence of poverty and the ineffectiveness of many welfare programs in getting people participating in society. But what I think is driving the recent interest in part is some of the things that have gotten it into the news, like the referendum that took place in Switzerland and these pilot projects.
A referendum on whether or not to have a universal basic income in Switzerland.
That's right. Right. And it was defeated, but the percentage of people favoring it went up from the time that it was first launched. And in Switzerland, people are saying it's not the end of the matter, it's the beginning of a conversation. And here in the United States, in particular, I think what is pushing a lot of the current interest has to do with the fear that artificial intelligence and automation are going to put more people out of work than they are going to create new jobs, and that this is going to force a structural change in the nature of work in the United States, and that will require new kinds of solutions.
So, Amaya, what drew you to the idea?
Actually, so, last year, I was... Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. So, I ran for governor in the Democratic primary last year, and one of the things I did when I went around the state was talk about how the current set of politics is dividing urban and rural communities based on race and class and where people live.
Yeah.
And that poor white people are pit against poor black and brown people in urban areas. And so what I told people was like, look, we're at the intersection of race and class. The economy has changed dramatically over the last 40 years. Income inequality is growing rapidly every year. And automation is going to dramatically change the workforce such that there are 2 million jobs connected to truck driving and transportation and logistics. And when you automate those jobs, just know that 66% of long-haul truckers are middle-aged white men. If you put them out of work without having a bridge to the middle class or to be able to sustain themselves without having to go work at Walmart for $8 an hour, well, then these race and class issues are going to continue to grow. And as Chicago tries to lure Amazon's headquarters to the city, just know that Amazon is on the leading edge of automation. And so I want to have this conversation in the context of race, class, geography, automation, and say that, like, this is all intertwined and we cannot separate any of these issues from one another.
Okay, so when you were traveling around the state, when you're running for governor and now you're an alderman, when you're running around, what was the reaction? I mean, what did people say? Did people like this idea? Did they challenge you? Did you find there was a big divide between rural and urban in the responses?
Well, I mean, look, I said that, you know, in Illinois, Governor Rauner likes to pit poor white communities against urban areas, right? President Trump does the same thing. And one of the things that I found, and I spent most of my time being a Chicago Democrat, being a Chicago alderman in downstate communities, and one of the things that I found was a factory town that had been ravaged post-NAFTA, a factory town that had been ravaged because of offshoring or because of automation. And that happened 20 years ago. And people who used to make $20-$25 an hour then are making $8 and $9 an hour. They were promised investment post-NAFTA. The investment never came. And the only thing that came to their community was a Walmart or a Super Walmart. And so you can see how people's temperature is where it is today. And so this divide is very real, but it's rooted in economic instability. And automation, artificial intelligence, is going to heighten those divides. And I think it's important to get out ahead of it because you can see the racialized sort of politics we have where it's fear of the other. So when people get put out of work and they feel unstable, it's easy to fall into the arms of a demagogue or a carnival barker. And we need to get out ahead of these issues.
Okay, let's go to the phone lines. I want to go to Gene in Minneapolis. Gene?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I also agree that I think when people don't have a sense of purpose, and Republicans are really bent on, reducing safety social network programs, that this is, I agree with, that we're going to have more of a demagoguery, and we'll become a third world nation pretty quickly. And so I think this is really immoral to think that the wealthy class should just give out a little bit. And people don't have a sense of meaning in life.
So do you like the idea of the universal basic income, or you feel it's just that's the wrong approach to be taking?
That's really the wrong approach. We'll become a third world country. We're already doing that with the economic inequality.
And where does the third world country come in? Is because it's the universal
because
basic income
is so extreme.
Is so extreme.
And
so,
the other factors that are going on, there's like a current in the world of heading towards, if you want to call it fascism or dictatorships.
So, Michael, one of the things I want to build off of her question is the sense that it's widely noted that both conservatives and liberals like this idea of universal basic income, but they tend to have very different reasons for liking it. For example, Charles Murray, American Enterprise Institute, he's proposed a universal basic income of $13,000, $3,000, which is devoted toward health. It has to be toward health insurance. So essentially a $10,000. But in return, you get rid of Social Security, you get rid of food stamps, you get rid of housing vouchers, you know, you go through the whole list of government services. And that's what attracts him to universal basic income.
Right. Yeah. And I think maybe that's where the fear that your caller is expressing comes from. I would just say, you know, there are many varieties of basic income proposals, and the more progressive ones do not propose just savaging Medicare, Medicaid, other features of the welfare state, and just giving people a meager cash payment. This is designed as a policy. It might replace some features of the current cash handouts. For example, we might dispense with food stamps and replace it with a basic income. But the idea is that this will provide everybody with income security to complement the security that we have with health care with respect to Medicare, for example. And rather than exacerbating the inequalities between the wealthiest 1% and the rest of the population, a basic income would most likely rectify some of that inequality by increasing the income going to poor and middle-class families by raising taxes on people who are in the upper income brackets.
And there is a very attractive element to this, which is, and there's a lot of evidence, isn't there, that, you know, people are pretty smart when they deal with cash. I mean, why should, you know, one of the distinctions in our society is if you have after-tax income, we pretty much, as long as you stay within, you know, legal bounds, you can spend your money the way you want. But people have all kinds of freedom to tell you how you're going to spend your pre-tax dollars, right? And you have to spend it on this and this kind of food or whatever. So there is something really good about this notion of giving people cash and trusting them to be smart with it.
That's right. There's a prejudice that people are poor because they make bad decisions. And in fact, people are poor because they don't have money. And poor people aren't that different from anybody else. They just lack the resources. And we have evidence of this in some of the very poorest places in the world. We've had basic income pilot projects in Namibia and in India. And what people found there is that when you gave people cash, they knew best what to do with it. And they invested it wisely. They, rather than withdrawing from work, they actually increased their work effort. Alcoholism went down in Namibia. And you find these kinds of results wherever these kinds of pilots are introduced. So we have to get past the prejudices we have against the poor and treat them by the same standard we treat everybody else. Let them make the best decisions about how to use the cash.
I want to get back to the phones in just a minute, but I want to ask, Amai, your pilot proposal with a universal basic income in Chicago, now how would this work and what kind of information are you trying to gather from the pilot itself?
So we are going to hopefully put together a task force of community members and academic experts and leaders to develop the cohort. And certainly we want to collect information, but quite frankly, I agree with the professor. I don't need a study to tell me that poor people don't make bad decisions
right.
when they have more flexibility with dollars. I don't need a study to do that, but I understand that there are critics out there, so you know, studying it in some way is important. I will say this. Before I became alderman, I studied and researched the connections between disaster and poverty. And one of the things that we found over and over again across a century of disasters is that our policy is rooted in this idea that some people deserve more than others. And when you design public policy based on this idea that you want to prevent this tiny little group of people from cheating the system, you end up with a really bad public policy. And this is where we are in the United States today. That's the sickness in our American policy, is we believe poor people make bad decisions. And it's time to totally end that narrative. And this is where UBI, or Universal Basic Income, can play a major role.
All right, let's go to the phone. And Wood, and you're in Golden Valley, right, Wood?
Yes, I just walked into work, so I got to duck off to the side.
Okay.
One of your two commentators said that they said that Universal Basic Income is kind of a newer proposal to the solution or the problem of automation.
Well, it's gained credence. It's been around for a long time, but it's gained credence recently. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. But that problem of automation has been around for quite a while.
Yes.
Kurt Vonnegut's first novel was called Player Piano. And
great novel. Loved it. I love Player. Yes.
Yeah. For those who haven't read it, like the plot is 90% of people are put out of work because machines are doing all the work. And there wasn't a great solution proposed in the novel, but that question of what do we do when all of our jobs are automated is still around. And now we have to worry about self-driving cars and assembly lines and what happens when Amazon's warehouse becomes completely automated. Like, these problems are still around, and they've been around for decades, and nothing has worked yet. So maybe a UBI could.
Right. But the other way of looking at it, and I'll toss this one to you, Michael, you know, I remember there was also there's Kurt Vonnegut, and then we can probably do all our cultural references. There was that wonderful movie with Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn, and the computer was just going to take over everything. It was, you know, and this was in the 1950s. There was a big automation scare. And the fact of the matter is jobs have continued to grow. I mean, I know we've had a tough economy recently, but, you know, if you look over the past half century of various spheres of automation, jobs have been redefined. Some jobs have been destroyed, but other jobs have been created. I mean, that's really been the story of automation, is that it hasn't led to mass unemployment.
That's right. That's been the historical record. And I think the jury's out on where we're at with it this time around. People who think that this time will be different point to the fact that artificial intelligence is replacing jobs that formerly were not replaced by automation. The earlier waves replaced basically muscle power, and now you're getting forms of artificial intelligence that can replace mental power, and it leaves very little for humans to do. So that's the argument on that side. However, some of the figures that, you know, half of the jobs are going to be eliminated in the next 20 or 30 years, there's some faulty methodology there, and some more cautious approaches have argued that the numbers might be quite a bit less. So I think the focus should be not on anticipating a jobless future, but anticipating a future that is really not that different from the present, where you have jobs being created, but they are part-time, they're temporary, they're precarious, they're low-paid. This is the situation people are already in. Partly as a result of automation, partly as a result of outsourcing, partly because of increasing amounts of the wealth that is generated going to the upper income brackets and not being shared more widely among the working class. So we need to address the situation of the changing nature of work, that work no longer pays. And one way to do that is to make sure that everybody gets a share of what I call the unearned income, income that comes from ownership of assets that's increasingly monopolized by a small group of people. And then people can work more flexibly to make income through wages.
Okay. Well, I want to go to Ron, who is in Stillwater, because Ron is asking one of the questions that I have, I believe. Ron?
Yes. My comment, first of all, is that technology has been improving for the last 200 years, and we have adjusted to that, and we will adjust to AI and other technology in the future. But my question is, why not just raise the minimum wage or give the workers a percent of the ownership?
Right. So, Amaya, this is raising one of the issues about the universal basic income is severed from work. And there are alternatives that would continue to sort of keep that attachment between work and income, raising the minimum wage, increasing the earned income tax credit. I mean, there are other ways of improving incomes on the lower end of the earning spectrum.
Definitely. And one of the things that my resolution for UBI calls for is a push for the modernization of the earned income tax credit. Because one of the things that we know for families that are struggling to make ends meet or families living in poverty is that while they qualify for the earned income tax credit, those dollars come at the end of the year, right? Or after you file your tax return.
Right.
And for many families, what you need is that smoothing, that month-to-month dollars in your pocket so that you can buy groceries or buy diapers or what have you. And so there needs to be a modernization of the earned income tax credit. That is for sure. And that is part of what we're calling for. Other cities are exploring a city-based earned income tax credit if they have a municipal income tax. I think all of this has to be a part of the broader equation and part of the conversation, because I think these economic changes are coming fast with automation. I think the Amazon warehousing thing is definitely real. I also think in Chicago context, you know, where Amazon's promising 50,000 jobs in exchange for billions in tax incentives, but there's no guarantee that the jobs that they promise won't be automated 4, 5, 6, 7 years down the line either. Because it's not as if these are only blue-collar or manufacturing jobs that are at risk. Radiologists will likely see automation come to their field, right? Artificial intelligence and other technology makes it easier to read scans better than a radiologist can. So I think this is an issue that we should be talking about in the context of the future of work, but also the rapidly growing income inequality, and start talking about what kind of supports are we going to provide working families such that they can get by and not continue down this downward spiral where those who where there's a growing divide between those who have and those who don't.
On the line, we have Bruce from Northfield. Bruce?
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for calling in.
Absolutely. I'm a Republican, and I've written an op-ed on this particular issue and studied it. And one of the points I make when I'm talking to my fellow Republicans in favor of this idea is that it has to be treated as a dividend. It cannot be means-tested, because if it's means-tested, then you create a us versus them that plays into the partisan splits that we get. And this is important enough that it needs to be bipartisan.
Okay, so this is where, if you're Bill Gates, you're going to participate in the, let's make up a number here, $10,000 universal basic income, including as well the residents, the poor residents of Chicago.
Exactly. What this does is it gives the basic income lets a poor person pretend that they're rich in the sense that they can try and start businesses, they can take on lower paying situations as part of their experiment in life and how they're going to live. I think it's an extremely interesting way to go. And if it annoys you that Bill Gates is going to get the same check, you could put a little extra on it, like requiring you report every year to the DMV and stand in line. He would probably forego the $10,000 in favor of not having to stand in line to certify.
Okay. So, Amaya, what do you think of the notion that this should not be means tested? This is for everybody.
Let me just say that the last caller, we need more Republicans like him to run for office. Hats off. I think the means tested part is wrapped up in this idea that, again, I don't think poor people make bad decisions. Right. I think you want to give them flexibility.
And I guess we should define means testing. You know, there's some sort of income level you qualify for a program, and then above that income level, you no longer qualify. Right. I mean, simple definition of means testing.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that. I think, though, before we go down that road, at least in Chicago, I am trying to focus on it as a poverty reduction conversation, and probably focus it from the sort of middle class down, because I think that is where income inequality really touches people from, you know, the middle class all the way down to the working poor. But I think, you know, not having a means tested program that is fully universal at some point is probably where we need to go.
All right. So now I want to go to Daniel in St. Paul. Daniel?
Hi.
Yeah.
My question is, if you estimate Chicagoland area alone, the metropolitan area, to be about 5 million people, and giving every person between $10,000 and $20,000 per year, you're looking at $50 billion to $100 billion. So where does that money come from?
Yeah, good question. I'm glad you asked that. And I'm going to start out with Amaya, because he raised Chicago. But actually, if you do it nationally, 300 million Americans, $10,000, $3 trillion nationally.
Yeah, so look at our defense budget. So we have no problems with certain priorities, right? Spending $1 trillion plus a year on defense for weapons and systems that we hardly ever use or never use and should never use. But here's the other thing. When you give people that money, provide that income, they're spending it. That is an economic stimulus. They're spending it in small businesses. They're going to pay taxes on it. They're going to pay sales taxes. They might buy property, which then leads to property taxes. So the idea that the money just goes and never gets realized in any other way is just not true. So the question is, where are our priorities as a country? I fully acknowledge the caller's criticism is that it's hard to implement something like this at the municipal level. But the reason why I introduced it in Chicago is that we are the third largest city in the country. It seems that the only things that are happening in the country right now in protecting working people are happening at the municipal level. So it makes sense that we drive this conversation locally so that eventually when the federal government starts doing its job again, we can help drive that conversation.
So, Michael, what is your reaction? I mean, I think, you know, in conversations about universal basic income, people get persuaded. This is an intriguing idea. And then they run into, well, what's the cost of this? $3 trillion.
Right. And that's usually a conversation stopper. But I think the thing that is usually missed in these conversations and in a lot of commentary is that people fail to distinguish between the gross cost and the net cost. You know, the $3 trillion you quickly added up is the gross cost, what you would be paying out to every person if you gave a per capita grant of $1,000 a month or something like that. But the net cost, you have to realize everybody is a contributor as well as a recipient, and some people will be net recipients. They will get more in basic income than they will contribute in taxes. And other people will be net contributors. They will contribute more in taxes than they will receive in basic income. And when you add up who benefits and who loses, and you can do this in different ways depending on how you modify the taxes, but the net cost is arguably something like 1/6 the cost, the gross cost.
Okay.
Really looking at, because the government is taking money in one hand and giving it out with the other hand. None of this is really staying with the government. It's just a redistributive measure. And the net cost is going to be something, for those who are paying more in taxes than they're receiving in basic income, it's going to be something like a quarter of a trillion. And that's much more of a manageable kind of program. And that doesn't even consider what you might be phasing out in the way of other benefits that would become redundant once we had a basic income.
All right, let's go to Maureen, who's been very patiently waiting on the line in Stillwater, right? You're in Stillwater?
Yes, I am. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say I think this idea is baloney, and I don't think that you've really directly answered the question as to where the money is going to come from to fund this program. The bottom line is it's going to come from the taxpayer. And now that you're talking about redistributing wealth, that's really what it is about. Looking at defense budgets and different places our tax dollars go right now is all fine and good, but the bottom line is it's our tax dollars. And people like myself, who are just middle-class people and have worked hard all their life taking jobs that maybe they don't want to be in, are still going to continue to pay and pay and pay. So I just want to point that out to all of your listeners that nothing's free. And those of us who have worked hard and scrimped and saved and perhaps not taken the vacations or bought the toys that I see other people who make less money than me do, that bothers me.
Well,
finally, I just wanted to point out that this automation in our society is in part due to the higher wages that are being insisted upon. I had a small business for a while, and when you start talking about paying people $15 an hour, I can tell you it really affects the bottom line.
Okay.
So I would just suggest your callers address those two issues directly, because I don't see this as being any sort of a net win for myself, and I resent it.
Okay. Well, thank you for calling. And Amaya, you have probably dealt with both of these questions a lot. And what is your answer?
I think I understand her sentiments. But her comments are precisely why it is really hard to tackle income inequality in any meaningful way. Because what ends up happening is that the upper middle class fights the middle class fights the lower middle class, they fight the working class, and the working class fights the working poor, and everyone's fighting each other. And the thing is, we have to redefine what it means to be a working person. And what I tell people is, if you go to work, whether you're a doctor or a lawyer, a carpenter or a server, if you go to work and a majority of your income comes from going to work, you're a working person. But if a majority of your income comes from your money making you money, you are not a working person. And those folks, that the latter group I just talked about, are the ones who are pitting us all against one another such that nothing ever happens at the bottom. We're all at the bottom. And it's time that people recognize that if we can either have this sort of middle class, upper middle class, lower middle class warfare with one another, people who make 80,000 fight people making 60 and 40, or we can recognize that the economy is rigged in such a way that the people who are making billions pay a tiny fraction in taxes than everyone else. So her sentiments, I understand. I hear all the time. And what I'm asking people to do, working people to do, up and down the spectrum, is see what's actually happening and see why we're all fighting each other and none of us are getting ahead.
So, Mike, it seems like her question is, if you're going to create essentially what is a political movement to embrace universal basic income versus the alternatives,
yeah,
you have to be able to satisfy her questions.
Yeah, well, you know, it all depends on the fine details, but Carl Wiedekwist has done a back-of-the-envelope calculation.
And he is?
He is a philosopher and economist.
Okay.
At Georgetown University on the Cotter campus. And he also co-edited with me two books on Alaska's permanent fund dividend. And what he found is if you had a marginal tax rate to cover the cost of the basic income of 25%. That is, that's what people would pay on their earned income, everybody. Everybody making less than $95,000 a year household income would be net beneficiaries. So unless your caller is above that, the amount of taxes paid or basic income per se would be less than the income received at that marginal tax rate. Now, you could push it higher, and Chris Hughes, who's a co-founder of Facebook, proposes a $500 per month. It's not fully a basic income, but it's a kind of negative income tax. And the cost of that would be fully funded by increasing taxes on the upper 10% income bracket. So anybody below that would not be paying anything more in taxes, and you could get at least $500 per month.
Okay.
He does have some work requirements attached, but they're more flexible than what we currently have in the current welfare system.
Yeah, I have a whole bunch of follow-on questions to this, but I want to get back to the phones and the questioners. So, Ed, in Plymouth?
Yes, and I work in affordable housing, and this is interesting. A couple of weeks ago, I mentioned to a colleague at a meeting, I said, you know, if there was a minimum basic livable income for everyone in the country, we would eliminate so many multiple programs that people are probably currently dealing with: welfare, food stamps, affordable housing, health care, and eliminate huge bureaucracies. And how much money could we save just in the elimination of all of those huge bureaucracies? And a second comment question I have is, it seems to me in doing this, there would need to be a transition period, because a lot of people, you just give them money, they're not going to know what to do with it. They don't know how to budget. They don't know how to deal with, you know, they've been dealing with the welfare system all their lives. And all of a sudden you're saying, here's money, you're on your own. I think you'd really need to have a transitional period to teach people who haven't had that opportunity how to manage money.
Right. I mean, I'm never going to disagree with teaching and financial literacy, but always my suspicion is that people are a lot smarter with their money than we're giving them credit for. We just may not see it, and it may not be formal. But Amaya, what are your thoughts on this?
I think it costs more money to be poor. There's a lack of food access.
Yeah.
Harder to get around. You're not connected via public transportation, like the neighborhoods that are well-connected or wealthier are. I think I disagree with this idea again, and I'm going to keep reiterating this.
Yeah,
that poor people make bad decisions. I also think it's important to recognize that in Illinois, for example, the Heartland Alliance's social impact data shows that 50% of Illinoisans will experience poverty. Adults will experience poverty at some point in their life. And what that says to me is that it isn't like a permanent state of being. That's because of the way the economy is. You might work full time for a few months and be okay, and then all of a sudden your hours get cut because of an algorithm at work. And now all of a sudden you can't pay a bill, or you don't have $1,000 in the bank to cover an emergency. And all of a sudden now you're in poverty because you know, you have to take out a payday loan. So my point is, this isn't as if people are living years and decades making bad decisions, or they don't know what they're doing. Poor people are trying to do exactly what everyone else is: put food on the table, take care of their families, and make a better life for themselves. And so this is, again, goes back to, I think this is a sickness in American public policy and in our rhetoric
which is we think that people who have less somehow are in their situation because they've made bad decisions. And this narrative needs to be broken.
I want to go to Nathan. And Nathan, you're from Kansas City?
Yes, sir.
And so what's your observation or question?
Well, first of all, it's a fascinating topic. But my question is, how would giving someone $10,000, how would that change the fact that in poor neighborhoods you have a family dollar going in or a Dollar General or you have a super Walmart? How is that going to affect positive job growth in a poor area?
Oh, I'm glad you raised that question because this is just about jobs and work. Michael?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure how it would affect who's coming into poor neighborhoods. To kind of connect this with a question that was raised earlier about minimum wage, there's no reason why these policies can't be combined to raise the minimum wage as well as have a basic income floor, because not everybody is in waged employment. You have single parents who are at home with children. It's good that they're there taking care of their children, but they lack adequate resources. Basic income helps to address the situation that they're in. What basic income might do if it were universally applied is to change the dynamics in the labor market. You're giving people an income floor, and that enables them to do two kinds of things in relationship to the employment that's available. On the one hand, they may be able to do the kinds of work they want to do, but that they otherwise couldn't afford to do. For example, they might be able to take an internship where they learn important job skills, but it doesn't pay much or it doesn't pay anything. And the basic income enables them to do that work and then move on to higher paid employment. On the other hand, if they are faced with employers who are offering very poor working conditions and wages, particularly if the basic income is at $1,000 a month or more, they can say no to that employment and demand higher wages before taking on those jobs. So it puts the it gives a little more power in the pockets of people who are looking for work, and it gives them a little bit more bargaining power in dealing with those employers who come into their communities.
All right, let's go to Sam. And Sam is in Minneapolis. Hi, Sam.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I work in corporate marketing at a Fortune 500, and in our technology field, AI is becoming a huge piece of that. However, we've only seen an influx of roles where we need individuals who understand big data and big science and can help create the algorithms to run that AI. Mm-hmm. It needs a hand. But what we're finding is time and time again, employees who can't catch up quickly enough don't have anything to fall back on to go learn those new skills. And I'd be interested to hear from your guests how they see UBI is helping fill that gap so that somebody can go back to school, have income so they can still afford to go to school, to then catch up, because I think business transformation is happening so much faster than when machines were simply replacing jobs, and now AI is replacing it, and we're just going to continue to speed up.
I think that's an interesting observation. What do you think, Amaya?
That's a really great point. I think there's a couple things. One of the things that I did when I was running for governor is I talked about a New Deal, right? Similar to the FDR New Deal. And I talked about this need for a bridge between the jobs that are changing today to the jobs of tomorrow. Because one of the things that you saw in the 80s and 90s after NAFTA is lots of people who lost their jobs were told, well, we're going to train. And we're going to train you, but you need to go back to community college for 2 years. And if you're 45 or 50 or 55, to go to community college to learn a new skill for a job that may or may not exist in your community that might require you to move to another part of the country, I mean, it's a big ask, right? And what people are really looking for is, as communities change, as economies change, reinvestment in those same communities. And so I think there is a real mismatch between where jobs have left, where the jobs of today are, and what we need is a bridge to that. And so for that 55-year-old trucker who might lose their job to automation, yes, we should put in place training programs for his children or maybe his grandchildren. But the idea that that 55-year-old trucker is going to be able to go to community college and pick up skills and then go into big data, it's really unrealistic.
And I think that is where a lot of the resentment comes from. And certainly this is true as you visit coal towns, right?
Yeah.
Coal miners are not losing their jobs because of environmental regulation. They're losing their jobs to automation and changes in the energy industry. But telling a coal miner who's making 100 grand a year, putting food on the table, to then go to retraining with no income for 2 years for a job that may exist hundreds of miles away, again, look at the politics today. Look at the anger, the racial resentment. That's how you get to where we are today.
Yeah. Let's go to Tony in St. Cloud. And Tony, I understand you're a little bit skeptical of this conversation.
Yeah, just a couple of things. I completely agree with the woman that called before who didn't agree with it. He still has not directly answered the question, where exactly is the money going to come from? And I make about $35,000 a year. I could really, really use this. I have no money at all, and I want nothing to do with it. I am perfectly fine with the people who have investments making money off of their money and keeping it for themselves. I mean,
and what don't you like? And what don't you like about the idea? I mean, we could all use the money. What is it about the idea you don't like?
It's the principle behind it. You know what? He was talking about one class fighting the lower class, fighting the next lower class, and so on. Well, that's all fine and good. I understand his point. My problem with it is the opposite. I don't want someone else's money that I did not earn. That is not fair to them. It is not their responsibility to take care of me or my family. But I find it to be nonsense. I don't want that. That's not the way it should be. Good for them. And I will continue to work hard and hope for the best.
All right. So, Michael, this comes up a lot.
It does. And I think...
And this is a big part of the American ethos. I mean, this is a part of our identity.
It is. And the principle at the heart of his concern, I agree with, that earned income should be proportionately rewarded. But it's interesting when you read Chris Hughes's book on advocating a kind of minimum income scheme.
And he's a co-founder of Facebook, and he wrote this book.
And he wrote this book, and he tells his own personal story. And what he emphasizes throughout is how much the wealth that he has today is a matter of luck. He happened to be Zuckerberg's roommate. They happened to come up with this Facebook idea at a certain time. They happened to kind of corner the market on it. It could easily have been any number of other social media outlets that could have had the same success. And then they end up with all this wealth flowing in because they have, in effect, a kind of monopoly on the social media market. It's not that they actually are working at such a pace and with such skill that they earn all this money. It's unearned income that comes from having gotten hold of a certain amount of property. People who inherit wealth are in the same situation. So one way of thinking about a basic income is it's a way of, in our society, which is increasingly characterized by a small number of people controlling a large number of assets, it's a way of sharing that luck. It's not a matter of taking from people who've earned money and giving it to people who haven't earned it. It's taking the unearned wealth and making sure that the luck is shared a little more fairly than it is now.
Okay, so we just have like a minute left to this segment of the broadcast. So Amaya, I want to just, in 30 seconds, what would you like to leave people with thinking about the universal basic income?
Well, thank you again for having me. I would just like to tell people that, you know, 70% of Americans can't afford $1,000 emergency. 1 in 3 Americans can't afford to put diapers on their children. These are the kinds of stats that we keep talking about. People are really having a tough time making ends meet, and the economy is rapidly changing. And so what we should be doing as a society, as neighbors, is to start thinking about how we help one another in a economic setting where people aren't getting by or getting ahead. Universal basic income is just a way to level the playing field, just to help people get over that hump, and so we can start talking about working family support to lift everybody up across the spectrum.
So, Michael, you're a professor of philosophy. You have 30 seconds left. What is the question people should be thinking about?
The question is, how are we going to go forward in an era where we see rising inequality, increasing poverty,
rapid and dramatic changes in the labor market to ensure that everybody gets their fair share of the wealth that we produce as a society.
All right.
They can participate.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate both of you taking your time. Ameya Puar is an alderman in Chicago. Michael Howard is a professor of philosophy at the University of Maine. All right. Now, I am joined by senior producer Stephanie Curtis with her...
Five and five is what Carrie dubbed it, because I told her, how about I come on every week and give you five things to read, watch, experience, and I promise, because she's very impatient with me, she said, okay, I'll give you 5 minutes. You can do it in 5 minutes.
You can do it in 5 minutes, and now I want you to enlighten me.
All right. So one, this is hat tip to Will Logger, who's one of our digital producers here. There's this amazing article in The Verge by Sarah Jong, who's a writer and an attorney, and it's called Bad Romance: To Cash In on Kindle Unlimited, a Cabal of Authors Gamed Amazon's Algorithm. It's about romance novelists who are fighting over ridiculous titles and ridiculous ideas, like, well, mountain men, virginal mountain men as an idea that they try to copyright. And there's an actual legal battle going on over this. But it also shows you how people game the system with Kindle Unlimited and get you to click on a book. And you look at it like, I'm not going to read that book. But somebody out there just got 20 cents because you clicked on that. And though you don't even read it. And it's an amazing, amazing
article.
They
always figure out a way to game the system.
That's okay. Right.
Keep going.
Number two, The Decision Book. Have you ever seen this?
No.
I'm holding it up for Chris Farrell right now for you out there on Radio Land.
I like it because it's not a very thick book. It looks like it's a quick read.
It is a little book. It's called The Decision Book, 50 Models for Strategic Thinking. I picked it up at Content Bookstore in Northfield, which just anytime you go there, they just have the best books laid out that you haven't heard of, and you can't help but pick them up. And yeah. I always leave with
always
more books.
Always go to independent bookstores when you're traveling.
Exactly. And so this book has like one-page ways of helping to understand yourself better, understand others better, and is like the team model. Is your team up to the job? The Hersey Blanchard model, how to successfully manage your employees. And they're all in a little page with a little graph.
Should I be scared of you after you read this book?
You should, because I can manipulate you now. It's a great book.
You can game me.
And it would be really fun for anyone like starting out in the world or heading off to college.
Yeah.
It's just a fun gift book, and I love it, The Decision Book. A book that I'm probably not recommending to you, but to anyone out there who likes YA books, Libba Bray's Beauty Queens. It's from a couple years ago, and it is about a plane load of teenagers who are beauty queens in a competition, and they crash land on an island, and they need to survive. And it's not Lord of the Flies, because it's not the girls going against each other.
Okay.
It's about them banding together and fighting corporate greed, sexism. It is, and it's funny and rip-roaring and absurd, and it is so much fun to read. My daughter insisted that I read it. She's 12, and it is a YA book, not a middle grade book, so there's some racy stuff in there, but Beauty Queens is really, really fun.
I can see the movie.
Yeah, they've got to make a movie out of it. Number four, something to watch with a family, Nailed It. This is a baking show on Netflix. It's like the British Baking Show, except with incompetent Americans doing the baking. So they have people who are
terrible. Could you identify with this?
I could. They have people who are just regular people who are not really great bakers, and they have them try to recreate these amazing cakes or cupcakes or ridiculous baking projects. It is so funny. It's hosted by a woman named Nicole Byer, and my kids and I and my husband love to watch it together because, one, it's comedic, and two, the reveals of these horrible baking projects cracks me up every time.
Good thing you get to watch it,
yes.
Not eat it.
Yes, exactly. Oh, my gosh. Sometimes the faces they make when they eat these things. That's Nailed It. And finally, we always end with a song, Chris. And so Courtney Barnett, she's a punk rocker, singer-songwriter from Australia. And this is City Is Pretty, and it's a great, fun song to listen to with your speakers way up.
You know, that's what I love. You get in the car, you're by yourself, you're leaving work, crank up those speakers. Absolutely.
Here we go.
Well, thank you.
You're
Stephanie
welcome.
Stephanie Curtis is a senior producer at NPR News. Friends treat you like a stranger.
Programming is supported by Hennepin Healthcare, providing you with convenient primary and specialty care clinics located in Golden Valley, St. Anthony Village, Richfield, North Loop, downtown Minneapolis, and more. We're here for life. Learn more at hennepinhealthcare.org.
This is Minnesota Public Radio News, 91.1 KNOW, Minneapolis, St. Paul. It is 73 degrees and cloudy in the Twin Cities. So what are we going to have tonight? Tonight, we have a chance of showers, slight chances of thunderstorms in the evening, and then lows are going to be in the mid-60s. Wow. And the chance of rain is 50%. So Friday, always like Friday. Friday's a good day. Mostly cloudy. Again, chance of showers in the morning. High in the upper 70s. It seems like we're entering those periods of a lot of rain. The thing that I do like is that these evening temperatures, lows in the 60s. Now that is a reasonable temperature.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRI NPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.